Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really interesting guests with us. In the first half, we're going to talk to Dr. Anita Johnson, who is a director of an eating disorder program in Hawaii. And in the second half, we're going to talk to Dr. Sanam Hafiz on addictions. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
When and if the world gets a coronavirus vaccine, it will probably require two vaccinations given about a month apart, health officials say. National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Francis Collins told CNN last week that a one-dose vaccine would be ideal because of the cost and also because some people wouldn't show up for the second shot. He said there is certainly a chance that one or more of these vaccines might turn out to require two shots in order to get full immune response. That's one of the reasons to do the experiments and the research trials to find that out, he added. If what it takes to provide full protection for any of these is two doses, we want to know that. USA Today reported Thursday the first shot would prime the immune system, helping it recognize the virus, and the second shot would strengthen the immune response. June is time for people to bond with their pets, the American Heart Association says. Throughout the month, the AHA encourages people to make pets part of their workday as routines shift during the coronavirus pandemic. Although your contact with other people may be limited, your pet can provide some of that missing emotional and mental support that can keep you healthy. Here are five ways, the association says, pets can help mental health. They help lower work-related stress. They can help increase productivity. They help manage anxiety. Pets keep pet people active. And pets give a sense of togetherness. COVID-19 is taking a heavy toll on Americans' mental health, a new nationwide survey shows. Overall, psychological distress more than tripled between 2018 and this spring, from 4% of U.S. adults in 2018 to 14% in April. Beth McGinty, an associate professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore, said the findings from a survey of 1,500 adults suggest the need to prepare for a wave of mental illness once the pandemic passes. In a university news release, McGinty said, "It's especially important to identify mental illness treatment needs and connect people to services, with a focus on groups with high psychological distress, including young adults, adults in low-income households, and Hispanics." The findings were published online June 3rd in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's become clear that many people with the infection lose their sense of smell and taste, and doctors are concerned that some will never get back to normal. At this point, it's hard to know how common the symptom is. First, there are anecdotal reports of COVID-19 patients who had lost their ability to smell or taste, said Dr. Nicholas Rowan, an assistant professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. And then he said studies started to confirm there's a lot of truth to it. Rowan pointed to one study of patients hospitalized for COVID-19 that used objective tests to help detect smell dysfunction. Nearly all patients, 98%, showed some loss of smell.
We have Dr. Anita Johnson with us today. She's authored the book Eating in the Light of the Moon, and she's co-creator of the Light of the Moon Cafe, as well as executive director of an eating disorder program in Hawaii. So it's so good to have you here with us today, Anita.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You have been a clinical psychologist for many, many decades now, and has the work always been around food and around healthy eating?
Well, yes and no. That has been an area that I have specialized in for 35 years. But it gets a little tricky because issues around food are about food and they're not about food. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, I deal with a whole host of other kinds of issues that are connected and get expressed through eating behaviors.
And the title of your book and the Light of the Moon Cafe suggests that it's more women. Is it why would women have more issue around this?
Well, that was my initial focus because when I first started, I was in 1982, and I was supervising a young intern at, from the University of Hawaii who was doing her doctoral dissertation on eating disorders. And what we discovered as we were talking about this is that there was a big problem. And so we created a center, and it was one of those things you created and they come, and it was girls and women that showed up in those days. Males didn't. And they came from all walks of life, all ages, all sizes, all ethnicities, all struggling with eating and body image issues. So on one hand, so I started working with women, But as I dove deeper into what the struggle was really about, what I discovered, it was more than women. It was the struggle was with the feminine principle, which is very different from gender. So the feminine principle is a depth psychology idea of, it's more like yin and yang. So we have the masculine principle, also called yang, which is outwardly focused and goal and achievement and oriented success. And then we have the feminine or the yin, which is more emotional, instinctive, intuitive, and relational side of ourselves, regardless of what gender we have. It's within us. However, we happen to live in a culture that is more yang dominated, more masculine principle dominated. And so these folks, I discovered, were very emotionally sensitive, highly intuitive individuals that were trying to find some way to fit into a world that was the opposite of that.
And our world seems to be changing a little as far as the divine feminine having so much focus in the last decade anyway. I mean, it seems to really be evolving. Is there a change in how people are acting around that?
There is now awareness and there's language around it, which there wasn't back then when I wrote Eating in the Light of the Moon. So people are talking about it, but what many people don't recognize is they've already internalized an imbalance in values from the time they were quite small. And so even though there's now language around this, these internalized belief systems about how to deal with your feelings, for example, they're still there and raging away.
Anita, can you give us some examples of things you hear that kind of just set the red flag up where you're like, oh, that's it?
With
when you're speaking to someone and there's issues underneath, what is some of the literacy or language around, I guess, the Shakti energy or the Yang energy that's not allowing any feeling?
Well, the language is more metaphoric. Mm-hmm. So that's what I listen for. That gives me an idea of what might be going on. Because so much of our emotional expression and certainly our intuitive hunches have been devalued and dismissed, what happens is the struggle with eating starts speaking to us and for us. And so that's what I start to listen for, to get an idea of what hunger is really happening. So that's for starters, we're not taught that there's many kinds of hungers, right? We just think, a physical hunger. And we're not taught about all those emotional hungers or those spiritual hungers, hungers for what I call soul food, because these are hungers of the soul. So what happens if you can imagine this? Imagine two tanks, tank A, mm-hmm. tank B. We're just going to give them fancy names, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And tank A is the tank you fill when you're physically hungry and you fill it with food. Tank B is the tank you fill when you are emotionally or spiritually hungry and you fill it with things like attention, affection, appreciation, acknowledgement, meditation, prayer, and so on. But because we don't understand the different kinds of hungers, we get the two tanks confused. And before we know it, either tank A is full and overflowing, but we're still hungry, or we don't want to get close to tank A because it seems like the bottomless pit, like we're never going to stop. And so that often leads to either compulsive or binge eating, or on the other hand, restrictive eating. And so what has to happen is you have to tease the two tanks apart to find out what kind of hunger is really operational in that moment.
So there's really invisible forces behind the second tank that we're not aware of for the most part.
Exactly. But we can be aware of it. And so we can learn to tease the two tanks apart. And And the first step is what is called intuitive eating. I call it instinctual eating because for me it's more connected to your instincts to eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full, which requires finding your hunger and satiety sensations. They are actually sensations in the body. I feel like pizza is not a sensation, right? It's a thought. So learning to separate out what's the physical sensation in your body and where are you feeling it when you're hungry and what's the physical sensation you feel when you're full and where in your body do you feel it. So really learning to respond to those signals is a first start. But it gets a little complicated, okay? Because let's imagine you learned your hunger and satiety signals. You know them. You know that little tickle that's in your belly, or you know it as a warmth or a movement or some kind of sensation that's more of a whisper than a shout. Lightheaded, dizziness, stomach growling really loudly is not your hunger sensation. That's famished. And, of course, we all know what's going to happen if we wait to eat until we're famished.
Right.
Right, of course, all of us. Right?
Yes.
We're programmed that way. And the sensation, you know, some people say, well, if I say, how do you know when you're full? And they say, oh, it's hard to breathe, or I've to unbuckle my belt. No, that's stuffed.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the only sensation you know, then probably your body is not going to be the size that it was meant to be. So finding these sensations is an important first step. But then what happens? Let's say you know it. You go it to a T. And you're reaching for that pizza, and you check in, oh, not a hunger signal in sight, but you still want to eat that pizza. Well, guess what? Now you've just tumbled down Alice in Wonderland's rabbit hole and landed smack dab in Tank B. And in Tank B, pizza's not pizza. Food is not food.
Uh-huh.
What is it? It's a concrete physical symbol of that other kind of hunger that I was talking about that you're experiencing and may not even know it. So in a way, what happens is the food will guide you towards what those other hungers are, providing you don't confuse them with physical hungers.
Now,
but it's coded, though. That's part of the problem, is that those hungers are coded. They're embedded in the food, and in order to find out what they are, you have to crack the code.
Crack the code a little for us. Like, okay, we've got sweets, we've got sours, we've got salty. Does that make a difference?
Oh, yeah. It totally, because you see, remember, these other hungers are unconscious. What that means is they're out of your awareness.
Right.
So in order to know what they are, you have to bring them into your awareness. So the food itself is talking to you, but it's talking to you in metaphoric language. And so you have to understand what the metaphor is representing. So there is a simple way to get started that I suggest. And, of course, we're all different. So this is not completely the way it is for absolute everyone. But it's a good place to get started.
Mm-hmm.
And so sweet foods, a craving for sweet foods, typically has to do with feeling like there's not enough sweetness in your life or you're not sweet enough. Crunchy, salty foods are usually connected to unexpressed anger and frustration. A craving for warm foods is typically associated with a longing for emotional warmth. A craving for of spicy food typically is connected to either a fear of or a craving for excitement, stimulation, and change. And chocolate, we know about that from Valentine's Day, right?
Right.
Romance and sensuality and sexuality. And so once you understand this, and if any of your listeners want to know more, you can go to my website, lightofthemooncafe.com, and download the food metaphor guide. So anyone is welcome to that for free. Mm-hmm. But this is a way to start to look at it. So to give you an idea, I was working with a young woman, and she was struggling with bulimia, and I said to her, I said, okay, if there were one food that you wish you could eat and there were absolutely no consequences whatsoever, what would that food be? And she said, oh, it would be vanilla ice cream with strawberries on top. And so I said, well, I want you to imagine I've never had vanilla ice cream with strawberries on top, and you're going to tell me what's so fabulous about it. And she said, well, it's sweet, and it's smooth, and it's refreshing. Now, taking those words, when we took a look at what was going on in her life, her boyfriend at the time was accusing her of not being sweet enough. She had just hit a rough patch with her parents that she was desperately wanting to smooth out. Mm-hmm. And she was in a dead-end job in need of a refreshing change. And the food was trying to tell her about those hungers.
So there's a gift in this. There's a gift in all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why when I said it's about food and it's not about food,
yeah,
is you have to work with the paradox. And for me, that's where it gets really interesting and actually even a little bit of fun.
Anita, we're going to have to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about this.